good day wherever you may be. Welcome to Observations. We have Scott and a half a Kirk here. How's the half a Kirk doing?
I'm surviving, thank you.
Okay, yeah, he's got the flu today. Kirk, it's been pretty nasty out there this this past week or so since we last talked. One of the bad things, really, is that Muslims have been incapable of doing anything productive, have decided that maybe the best use of their time is to burn Israel to the ground. You know, it's our land. We want it. We covet it. So let's burn it to the ground.
Burn it to the ground. Let's destroy it. Makes sense to me.
Oh my goodness.
Okay.
And then you got, of course, the president-elect Trump, who became president-elect by essentially promising all manner of right-wing awful things to do. Has decided that, you know, I don't want to be the president really for those who elected me. I want to be a president for all people. We're just all going to get along. And all those promises I made, well, you can just forget about those because that doesn't really matter anymore.
Yeah, I kind of thought that was coming.
Can you imagine, though, his the two people that are in the highest pecking order for Secretary of State, which of course is the plum job, is General Petraeus. He's the guy that came up with the Awakening program that led to the civil war in Iraq, that broke the country into two pieces, and then led directly to the Awakening program of Petraeus. General Petraeus was the impetus for the Islamic State. The Islamic State grew directly out of that program.
Indeed.
And so that would be a really fine pick for Secretary of State, the man who's experience in doing things that are just deplorable. And, of course, he's not in the military anymore, and he's not even teaching anymore because he was convicted of inappropriate behavior. Yeah. In fact, what's interesting is that his most recent crime, among his many, is that he put classified information on his personal computer.
Well, that's vital if you're going to be Secretary of State.
That's a requirement now, isn't it?
We're going to put Hillary in jail for it. But as for my Secretary of State, we want him to be well rehearsed and it ahead of time.
Mm. Funny.
And the other person, of course, that he's picking is the man who said that Donald Trump is a fraud. Our Mormon pal, Romney.
You said no on Romney.
What are you doing there?
Oh, God. Can you imagine a person dumb enough to be a Mormon as Secretary of State of the United States? I mean, why not, huh?
Why not? I mean, if you're going to all go to hell in a handbasket, let's all jump in.
Yeah, the Ohio State had a man wielding a butcher knife and driving a car into a crowd, screaming, of course, Allahu Akbar, with all sorts of Islamic slogans on his computer, and his reading list was from the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. You know, the authorities can't figure out what his motive was.
You mean that
senseless
shooting that
prior to that, he had an interview where he wanted to be, you know, he was worried about him. He's a Muslim. He said, I'm a Muslim. I want to pray, and I know that's going to cause hostility.
I mean,
like it's a secret he was a Muslim.
You know, it's so funny. Yeah, what's so funny is that they're justifying his attack by saying that he was afraid to pray.
Yeah.
So you can be so warped in your mental capability in journalism that you can say the attack, which was an actual attack where he drove a car deliberately into people he did not know for the express purpose of maiming them, and then jumped out with a butcher knife, and that was justified because he thought he might be harassed if he prayed.
Yeah, that's a lot. logical. Oh, gosh, that's just brilliant.
It's absolutely brilliant. And, you know, of course, I just really love the reason of the ability to reason of Muslims, that the justification for doing these things, for injuring and attempting to kill these people that he didn't even know, was that in, I think it's some country like Myanmar, some country, you know, that America actually has nothing to do with, that Muslims are being raped. Now I would ask you, who rapes most Muslim girls?
Muslims.
I guess Muslim men.
Yeah. Who is responsible for gang raping tens of thousands of Christians in Iraq, Syria, Egypt, and Nigeria?
The Muslims.
That would be Muslims. And this person thinks that it's appropriate as a Muslim for his to defend his religion by trying to maim and butcher people that he doesn't even know. I mean, how in the hell could you be that stupid?
Well, apparently you can. I mean, it's not that he's that stupid, it's that the press lets him get away with it. They repeat it.
Yeah.
That's the tragic, the most tragic.
Well, they came out initially, they said it was a gun. Another gun.
Oh, yeah. There was a gun.
Yeah.
For the cop.
Police, yeah.
Yeah, that cop shot him.
Cop shot him, yeah.
Oh, it's...
Well, you know, the point you made years ago about Ku Klux Klan, he said the only thing it took for them to do is to expose it for the religious horror that
right.
And that ended it big time. I mean, you have to have a remnant, but it's ended it big time.
That's all you need to do with Islam.
Yeah, but they never learned that for Islam. They never learned that for anything. They do it. They did it against the mafia. And you do it against the criminals, and once you expose their evil, it turns against them. But they can't do it with Islam for whatever reason, because somebody called it a religion. What is it? How does it define itself as a religion?
You know, the thing that is just astonishing to me is that with a religion that is has mutilated the genitals of over 200 million little girls.
Yes.
And that punishes, publicly whips and kills. In fact, fathers will deliberately torture and murder their own daughters if they're raped. So in a religion where a woman is tortured and murdered if she is raped, that you don't have a single liberal woman, a single feminist, out condemning Islam.
Who would stand out in the public and say so, yeah.
Right.
That's tragic for us.
It is tragic for us. And so anyway, that's God. In fact, but what we're going to do today is we're transitioning in Yeshaya. We had begun the second chapter of Yeshaya, Isaiah, and as we had begun that, Yahweh was talking about this great reunion that's going to take place, how he's going to build his home for his family on the highest summit of Mount Moriah, which would be up there where there is nothing currently, right above Golgotha, therefore not on the Temple Mount, and that he was going to celebrate there with Gentiles and ultimately with Yehuda. And talked about just how marvelous the empowerment this is going to take place there, and how we're all going to be transformed into light and to just be extraordinarily joyous. You spoke of a gathering of a number of Yehudim of covenant members at your home this prior weekend, and just how marvelous it was to have meaningful conversations about Yahweh and our future. Well, that's the kind of thing that's going to occur. Now, that does not happen in isolation. Context is always important, and that does not happen in isolation. So, there is a something that is also has to happen for us to have a family celebration on Earth, and not have to grimace about all of the religious muck that is going on around the world. So what has to happen for us to be in a situation where 100% of the conversation is joyous?
We have to destroy the Babylon and all the remnants of it.
Exactly. And fortunately, we are not going to...
He does, yes.
That is correct.
The one that is right to do so, yes.
That is correct. Yep. Yep. It's a simple situation where he has the ability to do it and will do it. And this is the story then of him doing it. So if you're one of those who is a Christian and you're looking forward to the second coming, well, this is what you're going to experience. And it isn't good. If you are someone who is patriotic or militaristic or have decided that, you know, that the world leader is not so bad. He forgave my debt. He is offering all sorts of incentives just for a little Heil Hitler loyalty. That's really all it required. Well, this is what you should expect. It reads, then, the haughty and the arrogant, the conceited, the high-ranking officials, those with artificially elevated status, essentially the exalted and the empowered, from Goba, the lofty dimensions. The appearance, perspective, and perceptions of mankind shall be diminished and degraded. So then the haughty and arrogant appearance, perspective, and perceptions of humankind, mankind, of Adam, shall be diminished and degraded, reducing and collapsing the spatial dimensions of those individuals.
Oh. And
you know, we know as we study the covenant that the benefit of being part of the covenant is to have your dimensions increased. We're going to go from 3.5 dimensions to three-dimensional construct stuck in the ordinary flow of time, 3.5 dimensions. And ultimately, we're going to become seven-dimensional, like Yahweh. But the interesting thing about the end of the tribulation, about the last 3 years of the tribulation, you reach a point where Yahweh says, you know, it's just over. We're going to play out the last 3.5 years to for my timing, but in terms of the opportunity to join my family, it's over. You either join the covenant now before the tribulation begins, or you endure the incredible torment that is going to be part of it and join in the first 3.5 years of the tribulation, or it's over. And so this is the only period of time where God can say this in totality, where he doesn't have to hedge his bet in any way or to couch his words. What he's saying is that everyone now in a position of leadership, bar none, yeah, are going to be diminished. Because just as we in the covenant have our souls empowered from 3.5 dimensions to seven, which is, by the way, not a twofold increase.
No, exponential.
Yeah, it's exponential. Between 2.5 and 3 is exponential. And then between 2.5 and 3.5 and 4 is exponential. And between 4 and 5, 5 and 6, 6 and 7, each of those are infinite.
Off the charts, yeah.
Yeah, infinite. Infinite. So that's the equation. But it also happens in reverse.
Yes, it does.
That those who have been opposed to Yahweh, those who are not part of his family, upon his return, they're going to be diminished. And it's the ultimate part of Yahweh that I really like. Totally fair.
Yeah.
If you're arrogant and empowered in this life, you're a religious leader, you're a world economic leader, you're a world political or military leader, all your power, all your fame, all your pride, all your ego, all those people exalting you.
Guess what?
Guess what? The most exalted is going to come and diminish you to the existence of a point. You're going to be no more than the period at the end of a sentence. You'll be infinite in time. and then constrained in all other ways.
Yeah. It's totally fitting in regards to the, understandable, I should say, in regards to the three options of your soul.
Yeah.
And it's scientific, as Roy will attest to.
Yeah.
So everything is scientific, is rational, and is fair.
It is fair. Yeah. Yep. So, approaching the most set apart aspect of Yahweh will be inaccessible that day, which is his day. What God is saying here is that since everyone who is in a leadership position here, in fact, it's more than just a leadership position, because it's not just, he didn't say, then the haughty and arrogant, the empowered, shall be diminished and degraded. He says, then the haughty and arrogant appearance, perspective, and perception of mankind shall be diminished and degraded. And that would be every socialist secular humanist. That would be every religious person that thinks somehow they're better.
Yeah.
That would be every person who is in a position where they value human institutions, where they value human knowledge, where they value human achievement. So that's just essentially everybody, isn't it, at that point?
Yeah, well, they've all taken the mark, too, on top of that. They've all followed by that stage of the game as well. But even without that, it's still...
Yeah, and so God is just saying that because they're going to be diminished, they're on the wrong side of the divide, that approaching the set-apart aspect of Yahweh will be absolutely inaccessible in that day.
Yeah, it's much corruption, you know, that has been exposed throughout the media, particularly on Shattering Myth shows and your books and things. It blows me away that so many people are not frightened to be patriotic, or I can't see the logic in it. I mean, if this is true and is irrefutable, why are you clinging to it?
That's exactly
staggering to me. I mean, what do you have to do to turn around? And they obviously won't. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having this situation here.
So here we are. God's saying, nope, it's too late to make that decision. You know how many people say, you know, well, maybe you're right, but, you know, I'm going to wait. And when he returns, you know, I'll make my decision at that time. No, you won't.
Oh, you say John 3:16 and everything will be cool.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and he's going to say, I don't recall speaking English. I don't recall speaking Greek from which this was translated. And I recall saying that in the context that explains specifically the importance of the Torah. In fact, I recall that that testimony that Yahweh Kanan wrote down in the third chapter of that book, that the first 15 statements were about my meeting with Nicodemus, who was a student of the Torah.
All right.
And by the way, his name wasn't Nicodemus. I don't even know what his name was, but it most certainly wasn't Nicodemus.
Yeah.
You know, Nicholas would be the Greek the Greek god of victory, and you had a 0% possibility that a Greek was going to be part of the Sanhedrin. Yeah, zero. So I mean, you know, that's one of the problems of translating things. Yeah, from Hebrew to Greek, to Latin, to English. But nonetheless, he's going to say, why didn't you pay attention to the context where I said, hey, since you're an expert on the Torah, how come you don't understand these things? And now you're just saying, well, all I got to do to believe? What did I tell this fellow whose name we do not know? Didn't I tell him that, you know, it's about understanding what's in the Torah that's going to make the difference? And then you come up with this line out of context. I just got to believe.
Yeah. The Lord Jesus Christ.
Oh.
Yeah. And then, yeah. He never has to hear the word Lord again. You know, that should scare you.
That should scare you. Yeah, I knew all those that are calling me Lord, Lord, are none of those calling me Lord, Lord are going to enter the kingdom of heaven. Oh, well, but we did great things in your name. We cast out demons in your name. We built these mighty cathedrals in your name. And he's going to say, yeah, right. I don't even have a clue who you are. Get away from me.
Why won't you just ask him? Well, what's my name?
Yeah, at that point, yeah, then what's my name?
What's my name?
Oh, Jesus Christ. Well, no, it isn't. I don't. By the way, I don't have a last name. And I don't have a Greek name. And, you know, this is not going to be multiple choice. So, no, you would be wrong.
You got one shot, pal.
On the way back from lunch today, I passed a car that the bumper sticker on the car said, "Put Christ back in Christmas." Well, I'm going to tell you, Christ has never been separated from Christmas.
No.
Because
you can't have Christmas without Christ.
No, of course. Yeah, yeah. And there is what he doesn't know is there's no connection of any kind between Christ and God. None. There's no connection between God and Christmas. And so this thing that they're proclaiming on behalf of their religion is not only inconsistent with God, pisses God off.
Mm-hmm.
God hates it. God was not born.
No. And he ain't going to die.
And when he arrived, it was on Tabernacles, which is Sukkah.
Yeah.
When a child was born unto us and a son was given to us, it was on Sukkah.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the birth of God. And his name wasn't Jesus.
Came in his father's name, didn't he?
Last time I checked.
So Zeus, what was God's name?
Yeah, it must have been Zeus.
Must have been Zeus.
Jesus, yes.
Oh, Jesus.
Indeed, surely.
Indeed.
By the way, the last statement, I just should repeat on that previous statement before we get to the next one. It says that he will be inaccessible in that day, which is his day.
Yes, his day.
His day. What do you think is his day? Do you think his day is Christmas? Oh boy, what a coincidence! If he come back on Christmas, no.
That
Christmas is not his day.
No.
No. Easter is not his day.
Yeah.
Sunday sure as hell is not his day. The 4th of July is not his day. So what is his day? And, you know, he has 7 days, so he says he's going to come back on his day. I know. How would you go about determining which of those seven is his day?
Well, I think it would be the seventh. Just a lucky guess.
It isn't the seventh. He's not returning on the seventh.
Oh, no, he comes back.
Yeah, he comes back on the sixth. On the sixth, McRae, not on the seventh.
Yeah.
Right.
Right, right, right.
What is the number? What is the number of man?
Six.
Who is he coming back for?
Man, a few of us.
What is the reason that God created the universe, the earth, and life?
For our family relationship.
There you go. And is that family relationship intact now, or is it severed?
It's pretty severed right now.
Yeah. So, what is the single most important day in Yahweh's calendar? If you were to say, "Hey, God, I need to know," I mean, from my perspective, the most important days are Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkudim.
Mm-hmm.
I really like those days. But from your perspective, not my perspective, what is your most important day?
Yeah,
and he's not going to say Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkudim. Those days were for us.
Yeah.
This was his day. What's his day? The day he gets to reconcile his relationship with his family.
Right.
That's why he's coming back on his day. There's only one day that fits that. He's coming back to deal with man, both good and bad, on his day, the day of reconciliation, Yom Kippurim. It makes absolute perfect sense. Okay, then it goes on to say, indeed, surely, the day for the approach of Yahweh. So this is the day that Yahweh is going to approach. You want to know what day this is? Now, it's just astounding to me that Christians are stupefied by this notion that no one knows the day. many times did God tell us the day?
All through the Torah.
So would you, are you saying when no one knows the day, are you suggesting that God thinks that those who read his Torah are so blankety-blank stupid that they have no clue what words mean?
That would be the implication.
I guess that would be the implication.
Yeah.
Of course, there... That line is just unbelievably stupid because it says the sun doesn't even know.
Well, the sun doesn't even know.
If the sun does not know, he ain't God. He ain't God. Oh my goodness, people, think. Okay, indeed, surely the day for the approach of Yahweh of the spiritual implements. He. You know, it's amazing, too, that as many times as Yahweh, and I'm guilty of this, so I'm right there with those that I'm pointing the finger at here. It is amazing that as often as people try to understand, you know, who Yahweh is and what we should call him, that he refers to himself as Yahweh Saba over and over and over again. Over and over and over again. And yet we humans don't ever bother to figure it out. He says, I am Yahweh of Saba. But what is a Saba? And why is he talking about the Saba? The Saba, there is no easy way to, I mean, just to start with. Saba does not mean host, unless you define host in a very narrow way.
Mm-hmm.
And host wouldn't tell you anything. I mean, these are not hostesses. This isn't, you know, your the male counterpart of a hostess. The Saba, and the best we can study the Hebrew term, means it's those individuals who are spiritual beings who serve as Yahweh's implements and messengers. You see, only a small aspect of Yahweh's presence can enter our world without destroying our world. I mean, yeah, it's just like if Walt Disney tried to fully enter the world of Mickey Mouse and go from three dimensions to two dimensions, he would completely obliterate the two-dimensional world. And he himself could not physically do it, but if he attempted to do it, he'd obliterate the two-dimensional construct of Mickey and Minnie Mouse.
See, for me, that explained almost everything. I mean, it finally figured out, you know, when, well, he can't enter, therefore he has to use a
correct
form, and now it all makes sense, you know.
Right.
So logical is...
Yes. So he has a number... Right. He has a number of... Right. He has a number of diminished forms. Well, God's pretty resourceful.
Yes.
One of those diminished forms is the set-apart spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the set-apart spirit is not diminished in terms of she is still entirely Yahweh. She's just not the entirety of Yahweh.
Right.
So it's Yahweh's nature, Yahweh's light, but part of Yahweh's nature and light, his maternal manifestation that is set apart from him that can empower, enrich, and protect members of his family. That's his set-apart spirit. But the set-apart spirit seems to only have, this is why I think he is talking about himself, Yahweh of the Saba here. The set-apart spirit can empower Kirk and Scott
mm-hmm.
and Craig.
Right.
Can enlighten Kirk, Scott, and Craig.
Yes, it can. Yes, you can.
Can provide comfort and companionship for Kirk, Scott, and Craig.
Mm-hmm.
But she does not engage with those who are outside the covenant. So the things that Yahweh wants done, he does not outside of his family, and his family's not here at this point, he does through the Saba. And the Saba are comprised of Malak. So, since God himself cannot micromanage and engage in all these people that give God credit for, you know, they hit the home run and they point to the sky with the one finger. God is not a micromanager. He has nothing to do with your little game. And to suggest he does is incredibly insulting to God. Rather than you earning brownie points for giving him credit, like Pujols does of the angels, you're mocking him. It's an absolute disgrace to do that. So anyway, the only way for God to engage, once is through the set apart spirit, but that's only for his family, and there's, you know, maybe a few thousand of us at any one time. He can engage through the most set apart, which is the set apart spirit on a physical manifestation. So set apart twice, which is Yosha. But, you know, Yosha has been here six times. He's going to appear a seventh time. He's not here all the time.
No.
And it would be an inappropriate tool to use. So that leaves God with his Malach, which as essentially energy beings, can do his bidding. For example,
Go find out what's going on, which he does.
Right. Yeah, there's lots of times where he sends them to find out what's going on. Even in the story that I've just finished with chapter 11 of Observations, the communication with Abraham is via a Malach. And yet, what's so interesting is this Malach speaks in first person as Yahuwah. Which means the Malach is an implement. You know, if I were to stand outside the building where Scott is right now, and I wanted to get everybody's attention, I could speak through a microphone.
Right.
One of those megaphones.
Right.
I could speak through one of those. It's still me speaking, but I'm using an implement. So the actual voice that's coming out is not mine. It is one that is generated by the implement.
Correct.
So he engages even with his family from time to time. This was the case with Abraham through the Malach, through the Saba. Another example is the 91st Mizmor Psalm of Dode, where he talks about having Malach stationed around us so that no harm can come to us if we're about his business. If we're doing a job that is dangerous and that it is in his interest to promise protection, right, to protect us to do that job. Now, God's not, you know, I got systemic poison ivy. I didn't go to God and say, oh, my God, this is just awful. You got to get rid of this for me. No, it has nothing to do with what his promise is. But if you're going to expose and condemn Islam and Muslims are murderous, you say, you know, I'll provide the protection for that. So he uses them for that purpose as well. The Ark of the Covenant.
Right.
It's with the two tablets of stone and the original autograph, the original copy of the scroll of the Torah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, is all right there, ready to be lifted at the Golgotha, at the base of the buttress of Mount Moriah. And it is a Malach that is protecting it, a Saba, a member of the Saba. So anyway, these Saba are envoys, implements that are spiritual, energy-based beings that represent Yahweh and are three and a half-dimensional construct. They can do whatever God wants to do. They're infinite beings, but they're tools.
Mm-hmm.
So that's who he's talking about, because and that is really the only way, apart from this, for those who are not part of the family, the only way for God to interact with those who are not part of the family is this way, through the Saba. So that's how he's introducing himself. And people, very few people actually take the time to think about that. And why they're named Saba, which is command and control. And how that relates to God saying that the Malach are both greater than humans, but also much less than humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that would louse up everybody's idea of what an angel is. Because in
right.
Fairyland, you know, where the angels are, whatever they are.
Yeah, loving beings, and they're incapable of love.
No. Yeah. So
incapable of love.
A tool or a
they're a tool.
A command construct thing. Yeah.
You know, I would friend of mine mentioned the other day, said, you know, Trump wants to be a president like he's a CEO of a company and just delegate things and just do the things that he himself wants to do. And they made that sound bad. And I said, wait a minute. You know, that is the best way to run any organization. Sure. But by the way, isn't that how God operates?
Sure.
Does the things that he wants to do, and he delegates with authority those things that he doesn't want to do, and he gives that to that stuff to the Moloch to take care of. That is their job.
Well, don't you think he's going to, and when we're all a family together, he's going to allow us to do an awful lot of stuff? I mean, that's the way he works.
Yes.
Or go play here.
Yeah. We're interesting to Yahweh because we have free will. Moloch right. do not have free will. We're interesting to Yahweh because we can be creative. And through choice, we can do things that are interesting. Moloch can't. So he orders the Moloch. They're a command and control regimen. And he invites and asks us. So that is the nature of this equation. Anyway.
It's just with a lot more respect now.
Yeah. So indeed and surely, the day for the approach of Yahweh of these spiritual implements shall be a time of degrading diminishment. Now, everybody said, oh, you know, hallelujah, it's going to be the return of God. It's going to be this glorious second coming. I'm here to tell you. No, God is saying, no, it's going to be a day of degrading diminishment.
Mm-hmm.
Because the earth needs to be cleansed of religion and militarism and politics and all of the oppressive regimes. And so
you just named everything that our whole society clings to.
Correct.
So what else do they respect? Apparently nothing else.
So his return is going to be a time of degrading diminishment. He's not coming back happy. You know, the last time he dealt with the earth in this condition was the flood.
Mm.
Was the flood.
Yeah.
Do you think the flood was a joyous event? No, he says, I regretted having created humankind.
And there's a sad line.
Yeah. And so this time the conditions are even worse. So do you think that he is coming back happy? No, it's a time of degrading diminishment against all of the arrogant and haughty elitists who have risen to positions of a power. Those who have ascended to positions of a power, the highest ranking and most prominent. Says it three different ways. He uses ge'ah, rum, and wa'al, to say, I'm going to diminish the arrogant, the elitist, those in positions of power and authority. If you're a pope, a cardinal, an archbishop, if you are the head of a mega church, if you're a general or an admiral or a colonel or captain,
or a media mogul.
If you're a media mogul or a star celebrity, you're in serious trouble. If you're a president or a prime minister or secretary of this, that, and the other,
state, go ahead.
If you're head of a central bank, a multinational corporation, you're in serious trouble. In fact, you're not in trouble. It's just over. Those are the people he's going to diminish. Indeed, surely, the day for the approach of Yahweh of the spiritual implements shall be a time of degrading diminishment against all of the arrogant and haughty elitists who have risen to positions of power and authority. Those who have ascended to positions of a power and the highest ranking and the most prominent. You know, God, even though this will be a time where I don't think there is the third door, you know, I think that at this point we have reached that everyone is either going to be part of the covenant or be locked up forever in Sheol.
Mm-hmm.
God's rage, his animosity, isn't and never has been focused on the victims of politics, the victims of religion.
No.
The victims of military conquest, the victims of economic conquest.
No.
And it's always on the perpetrators.
I totally agree.
And that's what he's saying here, that he's coming against the elitist.
Yeah.
Those who are empowered, the arrogant, the haughty, those in positions of authority, positions of power, the highest ranking and the most prominent, because they're the ones that have led people astray, and they're the ones that have demeaned and disabled and harmed his creation. They're the ones who have declared war.
Well, people forget he's the God of life.
Right. The creator of life. He hates it. And he hates those who have encouraged the killing. And he says, and I will be upon and against. Now, this is an interesting word. It's erez. And you look at any Bible, and they translated cedars, and I will attest, erez does mean cedars.
Mm-hmm.
But is that all erez means?
No, it's more of a metaphor.
Right. But it's not just, you know,
power.
If it was just a metaphor, okay, you'd say, well, the cedar is the strong and the powerful and the tall and the lofty. And so you'd say, all right, I'm against that. You know, the cedar would represent the Christmas tree and therefore Christmas. And you might say, all right, it's a metaphor for that. But all you really have to do is look at, well, what else does erez mean? Is cedar the only thing that it means? The answer is no. It says it means strong. It means established. It means those projecting power. It means to erect a large public, civic, or religious building. Erez even means to panel over something to conceal what's underneath, which is the purpose of purpose of Christmas and Easter. Yeah, purpose of Easter, Christmas, Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jesus, the Trinity, it's all conceals the truth that lies beneath it. You know, they put their lies right on top of the truth. And so, erez, yes, means cedars, and a metaphor via the cedars, the tall, the established, representing Christmas, of course, but also the strong and the established, a projection of power, which is what God is saying. That's what erez means. It means to project power. And then he says, I'm against Lebanon. Now, there's a lot of reason to be against Lebanon. You know, it went from being this country that decided to split power evenly between two different religions, the Falange Christians and the Sunni Muslims.
Right.
And they got to alternate who was president and who was prime minister, and they had a constitution that alternated between them. But, of course, with Islam doesn't play nice, and they went from blending power between two different sources to the civil war, and they came out just in this last year with a transition now with Hezbollah in power, thanks to the United States invading Iraq and giving Iraq to Iran. As a direct result of that, Hezbollah is now in sole control of Lebanon. So there's a lot of reasons to hate Lebanon. And the most fierce war that has been launched in modern time against Israel was launched from Lebanon by Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is almost infinitely better armed and equipped and trained than they were during their previous assault on Israel. And it was deadly the last time. So could God just be saying, you know, I am really disgusted by Lebanon because of the presence of Hezbollah and the anti-Israel terrorists there? Sure.
Oh, yeah.
But
it's more.
But it's more. Because what Lebanon means, and it is Lebanon, Lebanon in Hebrew, it means whitewashing. You know, it means to wear white robes. Well, okay, to wear white robes, that's it's Imams and the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
But to whitewash is to cover over his truth. That's the basis of Christianity. It's the basis of Islam. is to cover over, to whitewash his testimony, to put their New Testament right over the top of his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. That is to whitewash, to change the name of Yosha to Jesus. That is to whitewash.
Hashem.
Yep. So I will be upon and against all of the strong and established, those who whitewash and pave over, the high, overbearing, and haughty, Harum, the exalted and honored, Waha Nasa, and against all of the mightiest, especially the religions, worship of Allah as the greatest alone. The strong hand of idolatry, the promotion of false gods, the sight and symbol of pagan religious shrines. It is a derivative of, and is derived from, therefore, Allah. Meaning greater, larger, the mightiest God, today known as Allah.
Well, that question, Allahu Akbar, is going to be settled on Yom Kippur, isn't it?
God is so far, for all of those, all those little terrorist attacks, Allahu Akbar. Well, actually, Allahu Akbar, I think, will be settled at the midpoint of the tribulation. I think that the Magog War, screaming Allahu Akbar, which comes in two phases, Yahweh says that he personally intervenes, and that's right before the midpoint of the tribulation. So sometime in 2028, maybe, could be early 2029, but in that period of time, Yahweh himself is going to do Islam in. Yeah, so there'll be no more Allahu Akbars at this point in time. Which is, now, so there's two reasons for not rendering this I'm against cedars in Lebanon. Is because look at this, or even oaks at the end, is you look at the terms that are added to this list. I am against, and then it is this whole host of things. So, and by the way, the I am against isn't actually in the text there. It's just this is a long sentence. So surely the day for the approach of Yahweh, the spiritual implements, shall be a time of degrading diminishment against. And then it's against all of these things. The arrogant and haughty elitists in positions of authority, those who ascend to positions of power, the highest ranking and most prominent, those things all have a common trait, don't they? Mm-hmm. Then the next is the strong and established, the erez, those who whitewash and pave over, the lebon, the high, overbearing, and haughty, Harum, the exalted and honored, Ha-Nasa, those who are lifted up, and against all of the religious worship of Allah as the greatest. And then it ends, this is all of the Elon Bashan. Bashan. Now, Is God going to tell us, I'm really against, boy, I tell you what, in addition to diminishing the arrogant leaders of the world, I'm going to diminish the oaks of this place called Bashan.
No.
I'm going to diminish the cedars, and I'm going to diminish Lebanon. I don't leave the rest of the world just the way it is, because that's just fine. I'm going to be against and diminish Lebanon, cedars, and oaks of Bashan.
If you translated it that way, you'd be absurd. I mean,
you'd be a moron.
Ridiculous, yeah.
So what is Bashan?
This is my planet, and I like it. It's good. Here the animals are good. He's not against the animals. He's not against the tree.
Right. No.
We know that. We
got nothing. Got nothing against a tree. Got nothing against oaks. Got nothing against cedars.
No.
Invented both of them.
Yeah.
Both beautiful trees in their own right.
It will, yes.
Yes, but these are the alone, the religious worship of Allah as the greatest, of Bashan. Bashan is the serpent. Bashan means snake.
That old snake in the grass, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, it's also the disgrace of the lowly and little who tramples underfoot. So Bashan, yeah. Oh, no, that's not the deal here. This is, God's got a sense of humor.
Yeah.
The Bashan is to tell us two different things.
Okay.
That Allah is, in fact, the serpent.
Right.
Okay? So first and foremost, in your face, Allahu Akbar, pal, that's the devil. It's the serpent. Satan. Okay. All right?
Okay. I'm with you there.
But Bashan also means the disgrace of the lowly and little who tramples underfoot. Who is the lowly and little?
That's Paul.
What religion did Paul conceive?
Christianity.
What book did Paul write half of?
Big.
Yeah, he wrote half of the Christian New Testament. I'm against that. Now, the trample underfoot. This is not just the lowly and little. When Yahweh was going through the history of human organizations that he thought were beastly, and he started with Babylon and said that was the first beast that created religion and politics as we know it. And so that's the first beast. But that beast morphed into Persia. And then he said that that beast of Persia, so that Persia was essentially evolved from Babylon. All the evil and destructive nature of Babylon was morphed into Persia. And then he said the next beast was the Greece of Alexander the Great.
Alexander the Great, yeah.
And so all of the evil of Persia morphed into and was manifest by this beastly nature of Alexander the Not So Great.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, as bad as Alexander was, and he was murderous and a sun worshiper and a real scumbag, and a man prone to throw tizzy fits and didn't care how many people he killed. And Alexander the Great, of course, wanted to be worshipped as a god. That as bad as that was, God says what grew out of it was almost infinitely worse.
Yeah.
Imperial Rome, of course, attacked and destroyed Israel twice, and only country to do so. And was, you know, if you study the history of Imperial Rome, it would be hard to find a more despicable civilization in human history. But God says, you know, that isn't the beast that I hate the most or that is the most destructive. It is an Imperial Rome.
It's what came out of it.
It's what came out of Imperial Rome. There's only one thing that came out of Imperial Rome.
Yeah, the Roman Catholic Church.
Correct. Roman Catholic Church. And what does he say about the Roman Catholic Church? Because he has one line about the Roman Catholic Church that he uses to distinguish their influence on the world. What do they do to the world? It is described by Bashan.
They deceive them.
No. What does Bashan mean? Who trample underfoot. Trample underfoot is the specific thing that he says about the Roman Catholic Church that causes it to be the single most menacing institution in human history. They trample the whole world underfoot. So this is not just an identification. God's got a sense of humor here. He's identifying the worship of Allah as satanic, but he's saying part of that disgrace that I am against is Pauline Christianity, and most especially the Roman Catholic Church.
Well, you know, when you look at it and you're reading it and you see Allah as thrown out, you know, the worship of Allah as the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now you kind of think, okay, well, you know, we're
all Allahu Akbar.
You don't think about it. This little simple part down here,
right?
Of Sean the serpent, and all of a sudden, and lowly and little. That's what Paul's name means. I mean, it's and then trample underfoot. You don't miss a trick.
You know, there's 7 billion people.
He makes you dig for that one,
right? Oh yeah, 7 billion people on the planet, and I don't think there are 1,000 of the 7 billion.
They got that.
That got to the first part of that, which is that we're not talking about oaks. Allahu was used here to speak of Allah being presented as the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
and that the root of the word means to worship. And that the word actually speaks of those kinds of things those things that are people who incite others to worship a false god. This is from Alul, based upon someone claiming to have received a revelation from the deity with a message that is actually worthless. Well, there's no more worthless book ever written than the Quran. It's the worst book ever written. Muhammad claimed that he received a message from a deity, and it is based on an incitement to worship a false god. You couldn't have chosen a word more directly condemning of Allah and of Allahu Akbar, the terrorist scream on behalf of Islam, than alone. And yet, what you will find is that 99.999% of people think that he's against Oaks.
And they do go in the Masoretic translation.
Yeah, yeah, and then
James and whatever this also said, you know.
Yeah, and I'll
that he ain't talking about trees.
No, and then the last one of Bashan. There isn't one person in a thousand, even not one person in a million, that can tell you where Bashan is, because where Bashan is irrelevant. Bashan means the serpent, and it's the disgrace of the lowly and little who tramples underfoot.
Yeah.
The Bashan is satanic influence, Pauline influence, and the influence of the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah. They're all terrorist. Yeah.
Right. God chose a word for no. That means to acknowledge, to relate to accept. So it basically, yada means, you know, to know because you can relate to something.
Right.
But he chose a word for understanding, bien, that means you need to make connections between the things you've come to know, to understand.
Understand.
This whole process of understanding this prior statement is based upon bien. Making connections of what is yada known. Yeah, is it a little work? Yeah. Is that work rewarding and fun?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. So this is one of the reasons why you never should be superficial when trying to translate something that God has said. Now, he goes on, because he's, by the way, not done. And he says, and I will be against all of the mountains and elevated positions. Now, is he against mountains? No.
I don't think so. No.
No. But Har means an uplifted and elevated position.
Right.
Which have sought or ascribed high status for themselves. Now, mountains don't ascribe status for themselves.
No.
But those in elevated positions do. Right.
Right.
Yeah. You know, back in Rome, it was Capitoline. It was Capitoline Hill. Right? Mm-hmm. They had the high ground in Rome. Those were the generals and the military leader. What do we call our place of power in America?
Oh, we love to call it the Capitol.
Capitol Hill. It's named after the Roman. Mm-hmm. In fact, we both have a Senate.
Architecture. Everything.
Right. Yeah, so those who are on the hill is what he's saying. I'm against those on the hill that have ascribed status and power for themselves. And against all of the elevated positions, Giba, which are exalted and honored. So, again, if you're going to understand this, you know, you really have to take the time to study the words. Now, there's a revelation of Yahu Khan in the 17th chapter, which, you know, we don't know if it's accurate or not, because we don't have anything dating back to even before the 4th century. But the prophecy speaks of a malignancy which emanates from the city of seven hills. So since God has mentioned that he's against the hills, and you know that he's not against a hill. Okay, so you've got an option here. If you want to understand, what do you need to do?
You connect the dots.
Right. So tonight,
indeed,
we're going to do that very thing.
Next time.